From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Last week, a Jewish group temporarily suspended its boycott of the LA Times. The group had been boycotting the paper because of a perceived anti-Israel bias in its coverage. The LA Times is just one of a long list of major American news organizations that are being protested in some way currently. Others include the Miami Herald, Chicago Tribune, Philadelphia Inquirer, ABC's Nightline, National Public Radio, and the paper of record, The New York Times. Fred Ehrman is helping coordinate the protest against The New York Times, and he joins us now. Fred, welcome to On the Media.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So, can you give me a couple of examples of an anti-Israel slant in The Times?
Sure. There was a big issue made about a photograph that appeared on the front page of The Times a week ago Monday, the day after the rally. Here you had several hundred thousand Israeli marches, you had several hundred demonstrators, and the front page had a large photograph with the sign showing "End the Occupation." It totally distorted what happened there.
Which the Times later conceded.
There was an editor's note, and the only reason they printed that, there was such an outcry from readers. The Times didn't apologize and say it was a mistake, they just said it didn't really accurately reflect what happened. But this is not an isolated incident. There was a story maybe 2 months ago about two 18-year-old girls, a homicide bomber, a homicide killer, an 18-year-old girl who blew herself up and killed an innocent 18-year-old girl who was shopping for the Sabbath. And it kind of idealized both of them and how their lives crossed. Imagine if the Times on September 12th would have written a story saying Muhammad Atta, a 25-year-old suicide person who crashed his plane into the World Trade Center, and the 25-year-old bond trader at Cantor Fitzgerald, and how their lives crossed. This is losing moral clarity, and that's what I think the Times is missing, and this is what we are objecting to and what we are protesting against.
Do you think that most of the mistruths committed by the Times are due to factual errors or due to intent to deceive?
Both. I think most of the time it is nuance.
Why not just stop reading the Times altogether and pick up a paper that reports on Israel the way you'd like to see it reported?
Because the Times is the newspaper of record. It is highly influential. So it is vital that that newspaper report news not in a tendentious way, not slanted, and in a balanced way, in a fair way. And that's the only thing we're asking. We're not asking that the Times should agree with our point of view.
Let's parse some words here. You've been shying away from referring to your campaign to temporarily suspend subscriptions as a boycott. Why is that?
A more accurate word is protest. Can you use the word boycott? Yeah, but it's really a protest because a boycott, you're trying to hurt somebody else, and I'm not trying to hurt anybody. We're just trying to see if we can get the Times to focus on how a story is supposed to be written.
A lot of the news that is critical of Israel isn't just occurring in the American press. The media in Israel are also reporting a lot of the same stories in the same way. Do you think that the Israeli newspaper Haaretz is anti-Israel?
It's anti-government policy, yes. And I would be just as critical of Haaretz as I am of the New York Times.
But do you think they're biased against Israel?
They're biased against current Israeli policy, yes.
It sounds to me as if anyone who disagrees with your pro-government position is dismissed by you as biased.
It's not a matter of just being pro-government. The Haaretz has a point of view of a left-wing segment in Israel. Haaretz is a newspaper that continues to play the same record over and over again. Again, it's a point of view. Newspapers are entitled to it, their own point of view. Again, I want to stick to morality and truth. And I think in each of the instances that we are objecting to, and the objections have been sent to the Times through emails, through letters, they're disregarded.
Are you utterly convinced that there is only one truth to this situation?
You certainly can have opposing perspectives, but I think there's one truth when it comes to terrorism and when it comes to the victim. Mixing up the arsonist and the person whose house is burned is not equivalent. The moral equivalency that is too often practiced in the media is wrong, and that, I believe, is the truth.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Fred Ehrman has organized a one-month protest against the New York Times. Not all those who think newspapers could be doing a better job covering the Middle East fairly are canceling their subscriptions, however. In an editorial in the Jewish Week, editor and publisher Gary Rosenblatt states that he, too, finds the Times coverage lacking on occasion, but he still feels queasy about the use of a boycott. It's a dirty word to Jews for good reason, he writes. Gary joins us from his office in Times Square. Gary, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
So why don't you think the boycott is a good idea?
Well, first, I think it's ineffective. I don't think it's really going to hurt the New York Times. And I think the Jewish community does best in an open society, and that we risk becoming marginalized and diminishing our voice when we sort of cut ourselves off from an institution like the Times.
You wrote in your column about the numbing effect that protests like this could have on the editors and reporters who put together the news. You wrote that they may conclude in their own frustration that nothing they can do to a newspaper can pacify the complainers.
Yes, I once interviewed the editor of the Baltimore Sun when I was in Baltimore, and people in the Jewish community there felt the Baltimore Sun was anti-Israel. And he happened to be Jewish, and he kind of threw up his hands and said, if we printed the Torah on the front page of this paper every day, it wouldn't do any good.
But what about the frustration of the boycotters? What do you suggest that people with grievances do in lieu of boycotting?
Well, as I suggest in the piece, you know, writing letters, making calls, even meeting with editors, you know, making your case. I don't think it's a closed society that doesn't respond to criticism.
But, you know, the leaders of the current protest against the New York Times say that they've done precisely what you suggest, that they write, they call the editors, and they've only decided on a boycott after not noticing any change in the coverage.
Well, the irony is this past Sunday, the New York Times Magazine cover story was a lengthy and really well-done piece by Scott Anderson, who followed a group of Israeli reservists during the course of the West Bank incursion. It's kind of a piece I would, you know, encourage anybody who questions the morality of Israel's military to read. So did it happen because there was this boycott? I don't think so. I think it was probably in the works, you know, for a long time. And sometimes there are op-eds and editorials we agree with, and sometimes we don't, but I guess it's a matter of how we deal with our frustration. I think there's a lot of misplaced anger in the Jewish community these days.
You have a particular distaste for the notion of boycotting. Why?
Well, the Jewish community is well aware of the Arab boycott that was in place against Israel for decades. Even the people who are leading this protest, which in effect is a boycott, don't use the word boycott because they're not comfortable with the word.
Jewish groups aren't just targeting the New York Times here. They're making protests against almost every major newspaper and news outlet in the United States. Do you think this speaks to a mild form of paranoia among some American Jews, or is there an inherent problem in the way Israel is covered?
Well, I think it's a key question, and you know, they say even paranoids have real enemies. Many people in the Jewish community who are passionate about their concern for Israel start with that truth, that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East, that it has tried to make peace with the Arab states who have gone to war with them since the day Israel was founded. And I think the struggle for many people in the community is to acknowledge that, you know, the other side has another truth, whether or not we agree with it, but that the job of the newspaper is to try and be fair to all sides. As one newspaper man said to me, a lot of people in the community think that newspapers run like banks, and they really run more like delis. They're messy, and I think people in the business recognize that and acknowledge that mistakes are made, that people screw up. What concerns me is the feeling that some people have is that there's this inherent bias that starts in the executive offices and is filtered down, and I don't think that's the case. I think more likely is this almost obsession in the media with symmetry, in covering issues. And again, it leads to, you know, Israel retaliated today with a helicopter attack against an empty police building in response to, you know, a suicide bombing that killed 10 people. I don't think it's tit for tat, and I think there's great frustration that the media doesn't, you know, point that out more often.
Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Gary Rosenblatt is the editor and publisher of The Jewish Week.
And now for a few of your letters. On our discussion on whether China is unduly influencing the content of Hong Kong's South China Morning Post, Paul Maidment of Manhattan had this to say. The South China Morning Post has long genuflected in the direction of whomever was running Hong Kong. When I lived there in the 70s and the 80s, the joke was that the governor dictated the Post's editorials as he shaved each morning. But, he adds, the fate of an English-language paper in Hong Kong is less important to the health of a free press than what has happened to the much larger circulation Chinese-language press that was long divided into pro-Beijing and pro-Taiwan camps, with only Ming Pao as the independent voice of Hong Kongers, or at least middle-class Hong Kongers. Stilling that voice has been the greater hurt to a free press.
Wendy Levine of Greensboro, North Carolina, wrote in with this. Did you all do a little bit on the pervasive and ever-present Claritin ads that are on my television, internet, radio, every magazine I read, etc.? I know I heard something about this evil ad campaign. Well, perhaps allergy relief is not evil, but it is everywhere. And I just wanted to hear that little bit again, talking about this campaign, and I'm hoping you have all the answers.
Well, Wendy, in honor of your request and of allergy season, we will replay my memorable direct-to-consumer drug advertising piece at the end of the show, so stay tuned. And keep sending your requests to onthemedia@wnyc.org. And don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
And before we forget, many of you wrote in to correct us on our attribution gaffe. Of course, the great Cole Porter did not write the lyrics to Let's Call the Whole Thing Off. It was the great Ira Gershwin. And to make amends...
Yeah, my bad.
And to make amends here for your delectation... A few bars of perfection.
Better call the calling off.
Coming up, the birth of satellite radio and the death of Ally McBeal.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Since 1993, the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia has successfully prosecuted perpetrators of genocide and ethnic cleansing, relying heavily on voluntary testimony from reporters, aid workers, and governments alike. The key word here being voluntary. Last week, Jonathan Randall, formerly of The Washington Post, became the first journalist and the first American in the history of the court to be issued with a subpoena to testify. The trial he's being called for is that of former Serbian housing minister Radoslav Brzanin, accused of persecution and expulsion of more than 100,000 non-Serbs during the Bosnian War. Randall's interview with him was published in The Post in 1993. Now attorneys for the defense want to ask him some questions. Fiona Campbell is part of the legal team working to put Randall's subpoena aside. Fiona, welcome to OTM.
Thank you, Brooke.
This is the first time an American has been served with a subpoena by the international court. As an American, isn't he immune to such a court order?
Not immune, indeed not. This is an international tribunal with international rules, and the subpoena was validly served. The point is this, that Mr. Randall, in being called to give evidence, is being asked to describe his news-gathering activities. He's calling upon the tribunal to recognize the special status of journalists and to recognize that there is a principle of qualified privilege that only in certain very particular and compelling circumstances should journalists be called to give evidence.
Why do they have a special status?
Because they are independent operatives in a war zone. And re-emphasize that the story here is about the critical role that reporters, humanitarian workers, and other independent aid workers operate in a war zone. And their work can be hampered if they were later considered to be witnesses or compellable witnesses to a trial.
You said that compulsion is the issue here. Reporters can voluntarily testify. Does Mr. Randall support what the tribunal is trying to do?
Of course. Mr. Randall, more than anyone, who spent many, many months traveling Bosnia in a very difficult and horrible time, it was his very reports that highlighted the atrocities that were being committed back in 1992-1993. But this is about the competing public interests. On the one hand, the obligation to bring people to justice who have committed terrible crimes, and then on the other hand, the very need to protect the means by which we communicate these matters to the public and ensure that the public scrutiny that can prevent criminal activity in the future can be proceed unimpeded.
Do you think there ever is a time when a journalist should be forced to give evidence?
Yes. If the evidence is of such compelling nature where there is no alternative, no better evidence that can be called to assist in the resolution of an issue before a tribunal, then yes, it is very likely that the issues of bringing crime to justice will outweigh the competing interest of freedom of speech.
How do you suppose Mr. Randall will feel if the man being prosecuted in this case gets off because Mr. Randall didn't testify?
Well, that is a most unlikely outcome. The very point of this is that if Mr. Randall's evidence is unlikely to make or break any scenario before this tribunal. This is, as we said, about competing interests of justice, and those are not lightly tried. And Mr. Randall's primary concern is not for himself, but for the future role of journalists in conflict zones. It's a very dangerous and trying occupation, and it's most important that the news-gathering activities of journalists not be put at further risk by them becoming the witness for the prosecution or the witness for the defence. It, at worst, can lead to terrible personal danger, at best to manipulation of the very facts and truths that they are seeking to bring to the world.
Well, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure, Brooke.
Fiona Campbell is the senior solicitor in the firm Finers, Stevens, Innocent. She's the solicitor handling the case on behalf of Jonathan Randall in The Hague.
Seven months ago, we reported on the launch of XM Satellite Radio, which Fortune magazine has since called the product of the year and the first major advance in radio since FM emerged in the 1960s. XM and now competitor Sirius Satellite Radio each offer 100 channels of digital audio to subscribers willing to buy a new receiver and pay a $10 to $13 a month fee. XM is now heard in every state but Alaska and Hawaii. Sirius is available in 19 states. OTM's Paul Ingalls has this report on how these new services are doing with consumers and how commercial and public radio are reacting or not reacting.
Huge, huge, huge category.
Jim Kwasny leads the way to the Albuquerque Circuit City car stereo department. As audio-video sales manager, he makes no effort to control his excitement over the new satellite radio services.
And it's reinventing our business as we know it. And to say it's spurred growth in our categories is an understatement.
Nowadays, customers considering a new car stereo will hear their sales rep ask, "Do you want satellite radio with that?" So far, the response is mostly, "Satellite what?" And once it's explained, a majority are responding like this fella.
I don't know. I just listen to the radio for free, so I guess I just stay with the radio.
But on this day at this store, in just a couple of hours' time, three new subscribers sign up, joining approximately 77,000 nationwide who have become early adopters of the new technology. Hugh Panero is CEO of XM Radio, the first to market with virtually all the subscriptions so far.
Normally, what you would expect is that a new service like this, you know, coast-to-coast coverage and digital quality sound and lots of music would appeal to kind of younger males, you know, 18 to 25, which is typical of that group. But what we've been surprised by is that actually, when you look at the age, it is basically equally distributed among a variety of different age groups and really doesn't even fall off.
For $200 to $400 for a new receiver and a $10 to $13 monthly fee, these consumer pioneers are getting 100 channels of music, news, talk, sports, much of it commercial-free with XM radio, all of it commercial-free with Sirius satellite. Some, like 30-year-old Robert Saunders, a communications analyst in Bedminster, New Jersey, didn't need a sales pitch. He knew it was coming, had an XM radio installed in his car, and was waiting when the service signed on in the Northeast, November 14th, 2001.
A different country.
The first day, I was really just awestruck, kind of in shock at what was there. There was just so much choice, and one format that I'm very fond of is called cross country, which is new country music, which doesn't have all the twanginess. Another format I listened to is called Ngoma, which is Pan-African music. I found that really scintillating.
Hear all of these great African hits and more on Ngoma and XM Channel.
But the station that really got me was one called Fred, which is kind of a retrospective of alternative music.
Now we'll do Front Row Fred. It's a live music fantasy festival inside Fred and Yours Head. We'll hear music from the Dickies, Beastie Boys, Psychedelic Furs, Blondie, The Cure.
After about 45 minutes of continuous music, it almost brought a tear to my eye, and that's a really genuine feeling that I had, because it really was so different than what I'd experienced from commercial radio.
Back at Circuit City, customers who are signing up for satellite today all sing the same song. Commercial radio made them do it.
The broadcast radio around this town is, it's not that good. It's they overplay a lot of songs.
I mean, there's a variety. It's not like the local stations. They play, you know, what hour and what's coming up next, what song's going to play next, you know.
Different variety instead of commercial after commercial after commercial.
Broadcasting live from New York, home of the Sirius National Broadcast Studios, this is Ralph Totora on Classic Rock.
My view about satellite radio is that they are the anti-radio.
Jerry Del Caliano publishes Inside Radio, an industry newsletter, and is author of a book, The Future of Radio.
Terrestrial radio has been disconnected from the listener, and satellite radio has come along just at the time when they've been disconnected.
With most new satellite radio users saying they hardly listen to the local stations anymore, you'd think station owners would be taking notice. Del Caliano doesn't see it yet.
Satellite, it's just a pimple on their chin, so to speak, because they think of it in terms of, well, you know, they're not here yet, and, you know, they're not that much of a threat.
Others say that just as traditional TV adapted to the presence of cable, traditional radio will eventually change in response to satellite radio. Joe Clayton is CEO at Sirius Satellite.
Number one, I think they will embrace digital capability much faster, and two, look at their content and their commercial rotation much closer. When the technology changes, when your competition changes, and the consumer's taste change, you better change, or you end up being roadkill on the information superhighway.
Not unlike commercial broadcasters, most local public radio managers are saying it's too early to know the impact satellite radio will have on their listeners and contributors. But some of those managers are listening.
It's so good it's scary.
Vermont Public Radio Chief Mark Vogelzang bought an XM unit to check out the new competition.
As I channel surfed, I encountered music that has traditionally been in the domain of public radio. That is, new age music, bluegrass music, folk music, Tejano music. Typically on a public radio station, we might offer 2 hours at best. And suddenly on satellite radio, it's 24 hours a day of this.
What listeners won't get from satellite radio, though, is local content, which many public radio stations take pride in. It's what Richard Town, manager at KUNM in Albuquerque, hopes will keep even satellite subscribers who found a 24-hour blues channel coming back to his station's 3-hour weekly blues show.
Fans of that style of music are going to want to know what concerts are coming. They're going to want to tune in and hear interviews with the artists who are performing and win tickets to the local concert. So I think that the local edge still is going to hold audience for us, but it's too early to tell, I think.
Town may be less concerned about competition from the music channels than he is from the two NPR channels featured on the Sirius system.
I'm Bob Edwards. A new era is here. Satellite radio and satellite stations you hear from coast to coast. NPR is at the forefront of this new frontier, and you are too.
Even though NPR's Showcase Morning Edition and All Things Considered programs won't be on the satellite service, something comparable will be. Town expects some NPR listeners who had sent $10 a month to KUNM will start sending that $10 to satellite radio while listening to wall-to-wall NPR.
Welcome to NPR Now, in your car, all the time.
In the meantime, the debate continues over how many traditional radio listeners will be gobbled up by satellite services and how soon. XM needs 4 million subscribers, Sirius 3 million, before breaking even. Inside Radio's Jerry Del Caliano thinks satellite services will survive, will probably be bought out by broadcast companies, he says, and will ultimately be overrun as a provider of content by wireless internet technologies that we can't even yet imagine. Stay tuned. For On the Media, I'm Paul Ingalls.
Monday marks the last episode of Ally McBeal, the Emmy Award-winning Best Comedy Series, which was said to symbolize everything from the modern face of feminism to antiquated notions of female beauty. Or maybe it represented a joke that just got old, a television landscape that became edgier, or a culture whose attention span is smaller than the typical Ally McBeal miniskirt. The largest single reason that we'll remember McBeal as a touchstone is that Time magazine cover article which put Calista Flockhart's face next to Gloria Steinem's as the new face of feminism. Jinia Belafonte wrote that story. She also recently wrote an Ally McBeal obit for the New York Times. Jinia, welcome to OTM.
Thank you.
Well, let's go back to those reflective days of yesteryear. In 1998, what was Ally said to symbolize, and why was the show so controversial in its time?
You know, on the very superficial level, people originally were very worked up just about her sartorial, you know, presentation. She was meant to be a serious attorney who'd benefited from the women's movement. She got to go to Harvard Law School, and she's sort of flitting about in the tiny skirt and the sandals.
I am human, I am temperamental, I am guilty, and I'm ovulating.
But Ally McBeal did speak to a growing population of educated, unmarried women in cities and the lives they led. I mean, it certainly was more than just a TV show.
Well, what do you suppose was the major cause of Ally McBeal, the show's demise?
It became very one-note. Week after week, it would focus around just a complete, you know, an utterly ridiculous trial that always somehow had to do with relationships or gender wars and was completely unbelievable in every way. And it was weird in that way because we were meant to take her sort of romantic issues very seriously. They were supposed to be realistic, and it was set in this very kind of completely unrealistic working environment.
Well, let's go to a more modern iteration of a similar character, Sex and the City, which is a show that has been an unqualified success for HBO. It's about single women.
Yeah.
And is it a triumph because Sarah Jessica Parker's life is more realistic than Ally McBeal's, or is it that the jokes are just funnier and more sex?
I think perhaps it's neither. I don't think that those lives are particularly realistic. However, what is realistic is the relationship among the four women, and many single women living in cities across America are very, very dependent on those kind of female tribes to get through things. And I think what made Ally so unappealing to women, and it was predominantly going to be women who watched that show, was that Ally really didn't have any genuinely believable female relationship. She had a relationship with her secretary, where obviously there's, you know, the power differential there. It made her less sympathetic not to have that world of female friends. And what women relate to in Sex and the City, I think, predominantly is the friend group is family.
Well, I guess feminism itself has changed. Ally McBeal was an icon of post-feminism when you were allowed to, you know, worry about getting a man while also have a significant role in the workplace. But now we're in I don't know if there's a formal title for it, but a post-feminist period where Elizabeth Wurtzel's and their confessional self-involved literature don't seem to be as provocative as they once were. To what degree do you think that the evolution of feminism just simply made Ally McBeal irrelevant.
By the time Ally McBeal arrived on the air, what passed for feminist literature in the culture was really just memoir. It was very self-obsessed. It didn't stand for any kind of larger political or social condition.
It was shocking and it was titillating, but it wasn't in any way universal.
Right. And it was passing for a movement and for theory, and it just wasn't. Ally McBeal's own self-obsession, I think, it just came along at the right time, you know.
Even if I get past all my problems, I'm just going to go out and get new ones.
Your piece in Time magazine in 1998 followed the evolution of feminism through the prism of popular culture. If you were writing a similar piece today, what programming out there do you see that speaks for the larger question of where the society has gone?
There was a reality show that ended just a few weeks ago on ABC called The Bachelor. It was another show that really hit emotional hot buttons with people, again, about gender. I don't know if you know the premise of the show, but there was a bachelor in his early 30s, and he got to select from 25 women who were competing to be his wife, and it really is just the worst sort of pre-feminist nightmare.
Can you see the Time magazine cover with The Bachelor on it with the headline, Full Circle?
Yes, I can. I can, especially after the ratings, because the final episode was in the top 10.
All right. Well, Ginny Belafonte, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ginny Belafonte, formerly of Time, now writes for The New York Times.
Coming up, the GOP uses TV to sell the party to Spanish-speaking voters, and drug companies use commercials to punch up prescriptions.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, the Republican National Committee announced the launch of a 30-minute monthly Spanish-language television production, Abriendo Caminos. Promoted as a news magazine, the RNC says the new show will inform the Hispanic community about important political issues and Bush administration initiatives that directly affect their lives.
Obtenga su información directamente de los líderes del país. Abriendo Caminos.
Abriendo Caminos.
Abriendo Caminos will debut on Monday, May 20th, and will initially air on both Spanish-language networks Telemundo and Univision in six U.S. cities. Fresno, Miami, Denver, Las Vegas, Orlando, and Albuquerque. Joining me now is Sharon Castillo, currently Deputy Director of Communications for the RNC, and anchor of Abriendo Caminos. Ms. Castillo is no stranger to the news business. Before the RNC, she was Telemundo's Washington Bureau Chief. Sharon Castillo, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Now, the translation of Abriendo Caminos, depending on who's translating, is forging new paths or opening roads. How would you say in Spanish, a tough row to hoe? 23 million eligible voters in the Hispanic community. I think about 22.5 million of them are Democrats, aren't they?
A lot of Hispanics have a hereditary problem. As you know, mom and dad, grandparents were Democrats, and Hispanics are very loyal voters. But we know that under the leadership of President Bush, Hispanics are taking a fresh new look at the Republican Party. So it is our responsibility at the Republican National Committee that we communicate our message in the most effective way.
This is certainly a new path for you. You are at the Republican National Committee now, but you come out of the journalism world.
Absolutely. You know, when I decided to become a journalist, I was motivated by the impact I could have in the community. As a journalist, you're not only entertaining people, but you also have the responsibility of educate and inform. And the show is another way for me to do so. For example, our first edition will be dedicated to education.
The show has a news magazine segment style format, with each show having a headline segment, a segment that focuses on a major topic, interviews with Hispanic leaders, as well as a calendar segment announcing upcoming political events. I'm going to guess not Democratic political events. Give me some examples of headlines.
Well, for example, in the first edition, we're going to be talking about what's going on with the Trade Promotion Authority. We're going to highlight the Cinco de Mayo event at the White House. We're going to talk about really the latest developments out of the agencies or the White House or Capitol Hill.
Now, of course, I haven't seen the show yet because it hasn't debuted. But I have seen the promotional material, the essentially a television commercial that the RNC has prepared to introduce Abriendo Caminos. It sure looks like a television program. It looks very much like one of the actually the syndicated news-like shows that you see before prime time, hard copy and that sort of thing, in its style. It isn't a journalism program, though, is it?
Well, you know, we can debate what news is. My view is if it's true, if it's a fact, if it affects your daily life, it's news. I mean, I'd like to remind everybody that regular newscasts also have advertisements. And, you know, whether it's a print or a TV or a radio media outlet, everybody has their own editorial line. So this is no different.
Yes, the TV news shows have advertisements, but they aren't advertisements. If I'm in Albuquerque and turn on my Telemundo station and happen upon Abriendo Caminos, is there any way for me to know that it's a GOP program? Will I be able to tell?
Well, I think the stations will make the decision how to identify the program, but we're making a $1 million commitment on the promotion, production, and broadcast of Abriendo Caminos. And so it's public information. We're certainly not trying to hide the fact that it's produced by the GOP TV and it's paid for the RNC.
Just curious, if NBC came out with the Tom Daschle show and he used it as a forum to highlight all of his Democratic colleagues and his Democratic friends and Democratic issues, how would you as a loyal Republican react to that?
Right now, we hear that President Clinton is in conversations with NBC to have his own talk show. I would say more power to them, and that's a decision that NBC will have to decide if it's good for their network or not.
Sharon Castillo, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Sharon Castillo, a deputy communications director for the Republican National Committee, is also the anchorwoman of the new Republican program called Abriendo Caminos.
While journalists tend to rank pretty low on surveys that measure respect for professions, we at On the Media have noticed that two American heroes, Superman and Spider-Man, both have day jobs at newspapers. Clark Superman Kent is a reporter for the Daily Planet, and Peter Spider-Man Parker is a photojournalist for the more downmarket Daily Bugle. Given that over $200 million have already been spent for tickets to the Spider-Man film, we thought it was high time to consider the journalism ethics of the Bugle's editor, J. Jonah Jameson, and his counterpart at the Daily Planet, Perry White. Joining us now is Stacey D. Kramer, columnist for the Online Journalism Review and the operator of a journalism ethics listserv. Welcome to OTM.
Well, thank you very much. I guess I should point out that Peter Parker doesn't describe himself as a photojournalist.
Oh, how does he describe himself?
He's a photographer. He takes pictures, is the way he puts it. He's making no pretense at being a journalist or about ethics. He's concerned about Spider-Man's PR, and yet he keeps selling these pictures to the Daily Bugle, which has no compunction when it comes to labeling things that Spider-Man does as bad, even when they're good.
Which brings us to the ethics of the editor-in-chief of the Daily Bugle, J. Jonah Jameson, who is a hard-nosed, cigar-chomping, penny-pinching, let's not forget, really cheap editor of a cheap tabloid. But does that necessarily mean he's unethical?
He's a sensationalist. His ethics are aimed solely at selling the paper. And he also has his own very pointed view of the world. Maybe I should say warped pointed view of the world. The world, according to Jonah Jameson, is what you see in the Daily Bugle. It's not necessarily the world according to the way things happen.
But it's fair to say Spider-Man is a man wanted by the cops. He leaves webbing on public buildings. He interferes in police business. Is there any evidence that J. Jonah Jameson is actively censoring the news of Spider-Man's good deeds? Or is the Bugle's coverage just an example of how an event can have multiple interpretations?
Well, in part it's because Jonah doesn't really believe that anyone does anything out of good. And because he doesn't believe in it, he doesn't believe other people are capable of it.
Compare J. Jonah Jameson to Perry White.
Perry's a blowhard, but he's a good journalist. He's a good editor. He's somebody you can learn from.
Compare Perry White to Ben Bradley.
I'd say that Perry does things that Ben wouldn't do. He's in a different place. He's in a comic book. Also, he's in the, he's, even no matter how much they advance him, he still seems to me to be in the 50s. And the concept of ethics in the 50s, journalism ethics in the 50s, and journalism ethics now is pretty different. We're a lot more strict with ourselves.
Do you seriously think that the cartoon representations of journalists and publishers have any effect on the public's real-life attitudes towards this craft?
Not in a conscious way, but I do think it does have an impact. Well, right now, there's a very serious debate going on over coverage of the Middle East. One person looks at a picture, one person looks at a story and sees one thing, one looks at a story and sees another. Well, when you have in your mind that the last movie you saw has an editor who writes fake headlines or who distorts the news, even if they're a comic book character, at some point, you know, it's there. It's part of the last thing you thought about journalists. And it carries over. I don't think it's, I don't think it's a conscious thing, and I don't think it's something to stress over. It's just something that is there, and we're foolish if we think it doesn't exist.
So the moral of this story is comic books, no matter how many superheroes they employ as journalists, it's their publishers that are always going to make us look bad.
Yeah, I would say it's always the editor's fault, isn't it?
And on that note, Stacy, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Stacy D. Kramer is a columnist for the Online Journalism Review and an editor at large for Cable World magazine.
If it seems to you that suddenly prescription drug commercials are everywhere, you're not the first to notice.
Nozula may cause the following symptoms: itchy rashes, full body hair loss, projectile vomiting, gigantic eyeball, the condition known as hot dog fingers.
That side effects warning happens to be a joke from E-Trade, a discount broker using the ever presence of drug ads to make a point about investments. 5 years ago, there was no such genre to make fun of. But thanks to rule changes by the Food and Drug Administration, direct-to-consumer pitches for prescription medications, DTC for short, now are everywhere. $2.5 billion worth in the year 2000, 1% of all advertising expenditures in America. Claritin, Viagra, Celebrex, Prilosec, Xenical. How in the world did Xenical become a household name? Actually, I can answer that question.
Since Xenical blocks about one-third of the fat in the food you eat, you may experience gas with oily discharge, increased bowel movements, an urgent need to have them, and an inability to control them. Particularly,
possibly the most famous disclaimer since batteries not included. But some people are willing to put up with an acceptable level of bowel leakage in exchange for weight loss. And the stuff is selling. And it's selling in part because patients are walking into their doctor's offices and asking for it.
One of the things that advertising does is create demand. Is that necessarily a bad thing? I don't think so.
John Camp, a lawyer with Wiley, Rhine, and Fielding in Washington, has lobbied for drug advertisers in Congress.
Advertising doesn't make people buy a product. It sometimes helps them make a decision to try it once, but if it doesn't work, they're not going to do it again.
If Camp sounds defensive, that's because he's on the defensive. The explosion of DTC advertising has led to a corresponding barrage of criticism. It can be summarized as follows. Drug companies are using advertising to seduce patients with unnecessary drugs and gouging them in the bargain, driving prescription costs as a percentage of overall health care expenditures through the ceiling. Last year, an article in Mother Jones magazine posed the question, what does it mean for our health care when serious medicine is marketed like soap? The magazine's answer, naturally, was ominous. DTC advertising, concluded author Lisa Belkin, is wrong, unseemly, and potentially dangerous. Not a lonely position.
The number of circumstances in which a patient has a problem for which no drug should be prescribed, let alone whichever one's being advertised, is enormous.
Dr. Sidney Wolf is director of Public Citizens Health Research Group in Washington, an organization with many qualms about how medicine is practiced in this country. Wolf believes that advertising greatly exacerbates a general over-reliance on pharmacological therapy and does so intentionally. Doctors, pressured by the cost restraints of managed care, he says, have been transformed from orders givers to order takers.
The visit itself has gone from 20 minutes to 15 minutes to 10 minutes, whatever else. Patients walk into a doctor's office and prescriptions get written.
Dr. George Lundberg, former editor of the Journal of the American Medical Association, is founder of the healthcare website Medscape and author of Severed Trust, Why American Medicine Has to Be Fixed, which broadly criticizes direct-to-consumer advertising. I asked him to describe the most hellish hypothetical of DTC gone wrong.
Well, hell in that sort of situation would be a patient sees an ad for a drug, a tendency towards hypochondria is ignited, and the patient goes running off to the doctor insisting that they have this problem, which they don't have at all. Doctor does some tests, and one of the tests comes back and shows an abnormality. It turns out the abnormality is a false positive, and the patient gets prescribed that medication or some other medication. The patient has an adverse reaction to that particular chemical and drops over dead. That's hell.
Yeah, that would be hell. But there is heaven as well. Even Mother Jones acknowledges that the presence of DTC in the healthcare ecosystem drives patients to treatment. For instance, for every 1 million men who appear seeking Viagra for erectile dysfunction, 30,000 are discovered to have previously undiagnosed diabetes, 50,000 heart disease, and 140,000 high blood pressure. In other words, just because you're a hypochondriac doesn't mean you're not sick. If you present for treatment and the doctor does a proper history and examination, you may discover that your impotency, or your heartburn, or your mood swings, or your obesity has saved your life. Harry Sweeney is chairman of Dorland Sweeney Jones, a public relations agency specializing in healthcare.
Of all the people who go into a doctor as a direct result of DTC, about 75% of them, 3 out of 4, don't get into the prescription drug aspect of things at all. Of the people who do, about 1 in 4 don't get the drug that they asked for. So you're talking about a fraction of a fraction who actually wind up getting the prescription drug, the advertisement for which brought them into the doctor's office.
Brandishing these statistics from a Prevention magazine survey, Sweeney scoffs at the charge that DTC ads have turned the nation's physicians into a corps of Dr. Feelgoods, merrily dispensing prescriptions on demand.
My doctor is not a wimp. I can go in and describe symptoms to him and say, I saw a television commercial and I think my symptoms kind of match up. My doctor's not going to take my word for it. That's a bad doctor. That doesn't have anything to do with the advertising.
Furthermore, let us not give too much credit where too much credit isn't due. FDA rule changes and the corrosive effects of managed care and $2.5 billion per year of advertising may have converged to boost these drugs. But let's not forget the drugs themselves. Prozac for depression, Prilosec for gastrointestinal reflux disease, Lipitor for cholesterol. These are life-altering, sometimes life-saving treatments. They are hugely profitable blockbusters, not because advertising is tricking consumers and doctors, but because the drugs themselves are revolutionary. With an eye to bringing the revolution to the people, the American Medical Association, with qualifying caveats to its members, endorses DTC advertising. Still, that doesn't end the argument either, because the money raises big red flags. Critics such as Mother Jones Magazine, harboring an almost quaint leftist suspicion of the profit motive, take offense at just how much lucre drug companies are hauling in. That condemnation may be reflexive, but it isn't necessarily irrelevant. Prilosec, the antacid, costs $4.50 per capsule retail. Blockbusters are also budget busters, driving up the cost of care, perhaps intolerably. To finally determine if DTC advertising is a boon, or properly the bane of its critics, someone needs to evaluate the costs and benefits, not to individual patients, but to the healthcare system as a whole. George Lundberg.
If I were the head of the FDA today, I would try to map the best direct data I could as to the harms and benefits that happen to the American populace. And then I would survey the public at large and physicians at large about the benefits, harms, and costs and come up with a recommended decision at that point, expecting to be assailed from all sides, no matter what that decision was, on direct-to-consumer advertising or prescription drugs.
And if the whole endless argument gets him depressed, well, there's Prozac from Eli Lilly. Available only by prescription. Ask your doctor. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers with Sean Landis and Michael Cavanaugh, engineered by Dylan Keefe, Irene Trudell, and George Edwards, and edited by Brooke. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large, Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.org.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Bydell Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.